So in my 30 years or so, actually more than 30 years now of doing Buddhist practice and meditation practice, one of the things I can say is that anytime that I thought that this is what the Buddhist life was all about, I finally got it. It would change. And I'd go through another phase. And there's all these different phases to the practice over the years. And I've talked to people, a lot of people in the practice, and I say the same thing, that say that Buddhist practice is one thing. That it tends to kind of diminish or narrow it all much too quickly. We go through phases and different things get emphasized at different times, and different things seem to really the essential thing, and things change and something else seems essential. So that's a kind of a preface to the topic for today, which is loving kindness. And so as I talk about loving kindness, I hope you don't think that, oh, I'm not that way, or this is not for me, or it doesn't relate to me, or something like that. But rather that maybe be open to the idea that as you go through a lifetime of engaging in your life and doing some kind of spiritual practice, that the experience of love will maybe at some point become an important element of it. And maybe not today or tomorrow or next year, but at some point might be a phase where love becomes very important. And so for me, there are phases in my practice where love, loving kindness, compassion, became strong motivators for me. And there were many different flavors to what I would call love. And there were times when my motivation to do meditation practice and do Buddhist practice was very much motivated by, it was kind of like being in love, like falling in love. And the amazing thing about falling in love with kind of with practice is it's kind of like love without an object. So that's kind of strange. Usually you think there's an object for the love. But many of the feelings that the person can have in falling in love would also happen kind of with the Dharma or with the practice or the experiences of practice or the engagement of practice. And I found that there are times when the Buddhist practice seems relatively dry, emotionally dry, and times when it's emotionally quite rich. And I don't have this idea that it has to be one way. One way is better than the other. But certainly the times when it's been emotionally rich has been very important times of phases that I've gone through. And it's hard to imagine that over some period of time of practicing Buddhism, that there won't be times when the emotional life becomes quite rich, quite strong. And in particular, the emotional life around love. And love is something that many people desire, and there's a lot of money to be made on people's desire for love. And of course, lots is said about it. And it's also been said that there are different kinds of love. And there's romantic love, and there's the love of friends, there's the spiritual love, platonic love, different kinds of love. In Buddhism, there are four primary forms of healthy love that are championed. And these four kinds of love are called metta, karuna, mudita and upekkha. Those are the Pali words. And the in English, they're usually translated as loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So, four kinds of love. And in the particular tradition that IMC is part of, the Theravada tradition, the first one, loving kindness, is considered to be the foundation for the other three. So in other Buddhist traditions, sometimes they put primary emphasis on compassion. And sometimes compassion is seen as the foundation for the other three. But in our tradition, I don't know if it matters which one is, should be the foundation, because I don't think you're going to go wrong either way. But in our tradition, loving kindness is the foundation. And the idea of loving kindness is that loving kindness is a basic goodwill that is expressed in wanting someone, some being, to be happy. So it's a goodwill where you have goodwill for someone. May that person be happy, may that person succeed, may that person be safe, healthy, just, you know, may the person continue to be well or something. And sometimes that's seen as kind of being an open-heartedness, being open-hearted or kind-hearted. And when that kind-heartedness encounters someone that's suffering, then that kind-heartedness morphs a little bit and takes the form of compassion. And compassion is the desire, the motivation, to want that person to be free of their suffering. So it's a particular flavor of goodwill when we encounter suffering. When the basic goodwill encounters someone who is experiencing a lot of joy, a lot of success, and something really wonderful has happened to them, then that basic goodwill takes the form of appreciative joy or sympathetic joy. And you feel delighted. Wow, that's great. You know, you feel really happy. And then the fourth one, equanimity, is for many people the strangest one to equate with love, because equanimity in the popular mind sometimes can be seen as being kind of being emotionally flat or aloof or balanced or even in such a way that where's the emotion there? And in order to kind of try to illustrate the kind of love that equanimity might be, it's sometimes referred to as grandmotherly love. And so it's the kind of mind state that the grandmother as towards the children, the grandchildren, that's sometimes very different than the parents. Whereas the parents, especially new parents, can fret over every possible meaning and every possible spill and scrape, and it's so consequential in all the little details. Whereas the grandmother has raised children, has seen it all before, and so if the child says to the parent, "I hate you," the grandmother, you know, they know that four-year-olds say that periodically. And they also know that it's also possible that 10 minutes later they'll ask, "Will you marry me?" And so there's a certain kind of, you know, you see it in perspective. And so you're not caught by it. Whereas first-time parents, the first time they hear maybe the kids say, "I hate you," it's like, "Oh, should I get the psychologist? Now this is really terrible," and run around and... So I don't know if that's the best example, but the illustration, but the idea being that the grandmother's seen it all and is much more kind of balanced around some of these crises that might happen. And so there's love there with the grandmother, but that love then is more balanced than even. So four forms of love. And when I came to do Buddhist practice and I started, I had no interest in equating or love with the practice. And I had no idea, it didn't occur to me that there should be love as part of the package. I thought it was about enlightenment and wisdom and important things like that. Kind of creeping in through the back door of my psyche, my mind, there crept, you know, I was kind of focusing on enlightenment, wisdom, creeping in, kind of almost unbeknownst to me, was that I was being changed by the practice. And some of the important changes was that I wasn't getting enlightened, But I was getting compassionate. I was getting compassionate. That slowly my capacity for compassion grew. And the sense of compassion became something that was really beautiful. And something that I really came to cherish and love. You know, the capacity to... I mean, it's kind of a mixed thing, compassion, because you're also feeling suffering in the world. But also, it's also something quite beautiful. And I don't know if I told that to you here, maybe last week or some point recently, but the there's a very interesting study or discovery they've made about compassion. And that is that when there's healthy compassion, meaning when there's compassion that doesn't, it's not colored by anxiety or anger or something, when the compassion is clean and simple, that it seems that compassion releases a chemical in our system called oxytocin. And oxytocin has a number of functions, but one of the functions it does, it creates a sense of well-being. And so, you know, when the compassion is clean, it does feels kind of rightness, or feeling of wholeness, or something, feeling a sense of goodness, of well-being in the person who feels compassion. So it's no surprise, then, that the Dalai Lama would say that if you want to be happy, the route to happiness is cultivate your compassion. Be concerned about the welfare of others. And for some of us, it's counterintuitive, because we think that, if, you know, my happiness is about me, right? So I got to get in there to me and fix me and change me, or get the world to be align itself with me, because, you know, it's reasonable to be happy. And so, and happiness happens to me, so it's all about me. And then we're told, actually, if you want to be happy, maybe you have to, in some ways, loosen the focus on me and put some serious focus on others. And the kind of focus that somehow or other evokes compassion. And if you do that, then it seems like it's mechanistically reductionistic to say, well, in that case, if you do that, the oxytocin will flow. You know, we don't do it just for that, right? But it's interesting. And then it's interesting that, you know, one of the functions of oxytocin is that it's supposed to stimulate, or it stimulates labor when women are pregnant. And one of the things that inhibits oxytocin is adrenaline. And so if you get afraid and the adrenaline flows, then that inhibits the oxytocin. Now, it's said that this was really helpful when you're, you know, out there on the savannas of Africa giving birth and the lion comes along. Because then the adrenaline kind of stops the labor and you can get out of there, you can run. So there's a very wonderful kind of dynamic there. But I wonder how many of us can experience, you know, clean compassion. That compassion's not mixed up with fear or anxiety or anger or something. So I kind of like this biological idea, fact, because to me it's kind of an indication that compassion is kind of hardwired into us. You know, it's not something that's foreign to us. And you don't have to kind of go towards great spiritual metaphysical beliefs to kind of justify compassion. It's kind of like somehow in our physiology there, that the sense of feeling connected to others, feeling some concern for others, and it evoking some kind of love that I'm calling compassion. Can you hear me okay? Is it working? My voice is... I had a little bit of a cold. It's one of the things that happens when you have kids. Can you speak louder? Okay, I'll try. Have compassion for me. So so that's one of the things that happened to me as I practiced, was that I became more and more compassionate. And that was a surprise. And I did notice that it made me feel, in a certain kind of way, feel better. And I didn't think about the feeling better much, but I noticed that. And then as I continued my practice, my original practice was in the Zen tradition, and back when I practiced Zen in America and in Japan, there was never any discussion about love, and nothing about loving kindness. And in fact, if someone brought it up to me, I would have said, "Ah, that's just sentimental." And when eventually I first heard about the Buddhist practice of developing loving kindness or developing compassion, my idea was that's artificial. You know, to actually kind of, you know, do this practice to make you feel some kind of loving kindness or love. I mean, that seems, you know, love shouldn't be fabricated. So, it's kind of sentimental. You know, Zen students don't get sentimental, right? So, I just, you know, right to the heart of the matter. Cut through everything, the sword of wisdom. You know, and this sticky, gooey stuff of love, you know, that's, you know, just can get in the way of the sword. So then when I encountered this tradition, the Vipassana tradition, Theravada tradition, and some of the teachers started trying to teach me loving kindness, I did the thing that some people do sometimes, was I just tuned them out. You know, it's not for me, I'm not interested in that. And continued my merry way with doing what I was doing. And then, what happens, what happened to me, I think what can happen, is that the mindfulness practice that we do here is also a tenderizing practice. It kind of softens the crusts on the heart. Or say it a different way, that some of the ways in which we keep ourselves defended or afraid or blocked or attached or preoccupied or caught up in ourselves or all kinds of things, that all these ways in that are standing like crust or barriers towards the heart being open, the heart being sensitive, or the heart flowing, all those attachments get addressed, get looked at, get softened, get let go of. And so the practice of mindfulness kind of tenderizes the heart eventually. Eventually the crusts fall apart, fall off. And then you find yourself with this tender heart. And some people don't want to have a tender heart, because if you have a tender heart, what can happen? You don't know? You can have a broken heart. It can hurt. And I know people who just don't want to get close to that because it's going to hurt too much. So I love this story from the Jewish tradition of a school, like a yeshiva, where they had a plaque on the wall that said, in this school, we place the teachings on your hearts. So some student then asked at some point, why does it say you put the teachings on our hearts? Why don't you put it in our hearts? And the teacher said, oh, only God can put it in your hearts. We put it on your hearts, so when your heart breaks, the teachings fall in. So, dare I say there are advantages to having a broken heart? There are. And though often the pain and the way we relate to the pain doesn't allow us to kind of see how the teachings can fall in or the learning there, or that there's actually maybe an even more tender place to be touched. So at some point as I practice, this tenderness just started growing. Just a feeling of warmth for me, of warmth and sensitivity in the chest area, and feeling of wholeness and what I call love, kindness. And I was taken aback by it. I was really surprised. Where did that come from? I'm a Zen student. And this is not a fair characterization of Zen. This is just my, you know, silly, naive, uninformed projection. Having been a little bit of a macho Zen student. So, so then when the teacher started talking about loving kindness, then I had a ready reference wow, it's right here, I feel it. That's what they're talking about, this thing here. And when I felt it here, then the practice of loving kindness they were teaching made a lot of sense to me. And what the practice entails, when you actually do loving kindness as a practice, is you think of some person, it can be yourself, or it can be anybody else, but you think of someone for whom you want to have goodwill for, we have goodwill for. And you think about what your wishes are for that person that express that goodwill. Usually we say the intention you have for them. And so hopefully your goodwill for people, especially if you think about it, takes the forms of wishing something for them. May they be happy. May they be well. Maybe they're healthy. Maybe they're peaceful. May they be, you know, they're really great. Something. May they be something. So you consider what your wishes might be for that person. And then, in a way that some people liken to prayer, they use the word prayer occasionally for this practice, though some people cringe at the word, Buddhists do. The practice usually involves then saying repetitively a few phrases that express that wish you have for that person. And usually you can use no more than four phrases. So you kind of, it's kind of repetitive. You do the same thing over and over again. And the repetition allows you to kind of massage and work that intention and let it somehow begin working inside of you. In order for it to work inside of you, you have to be connected to the sense of that person, the presence of that person, somehow the image. Some people like to visualize the person. And you need to kind of be connected to your wish for that person, your intention for that person. And then those phrases. So those three elements are the key elements to loving kindness practice. So some way of holding the sense of the person in your mind or in your heart. Some sense at the same time of holding your wishes for that person. And then kind of in your mind saying those phrases that express that, give a voice, give expression to those wishes. And occasionally, there'll be a fourth element, and that is there'll be actually feelings of warmth, the feelings, emotions of goodwill and love that come with it. But they're not required to have the feelings. And then taking those three or those four elements together and kind of just kind of keep at it, keep coming back to it and come back to it. Don't let the mind wander off. The mind will wander off, but you keep coming back and let that be the focal point of the mind. And it's a kind of a concentration practice. We have to learn to keep the mind centered. And eventually the mind learns to be present and focused, stabilized, and doing that. And then as you get stabilized there, as the mind can keep doing it, then there's a chance sometimes that the tenderness of the heart or the love of the heart or this goodwill of the heart can grow and become stronger, more focused, and more present for you, more a resource for you in your life. And sometimes in meditation it can get quite beautiful, quite strong, when that's the primary concern of your mind, is goodwill. You're not worried about your taxes. You know, and think, oh, you know what, you know, it's only a few more days, and got to do it, this and that. Or you're not concerned about what you're going to have for dinner, or who yelled at you at work, or, you know, all these kinds of concerns we might have, who likes you, who doesn't like you, and all kinds of things. But all the ways in which mind gets fragmented and caught up in the dramas of life, they can fall away. And we get absorbed in this state, in this practice of goodwill, in the same way that you get absorbed in reading a really good book. And that is really great. I mean, that's, you know, is that a bad thing? Being absorbed in goodwill? Can you imagine? It's a lot of worse things you can do. So it's a really beautiful thing, and you're even though you're having goodwill for others, you're one of the primary beneficiaries of that. That somehow it kind of reorganizes a little bit the psyche and your priorities and how you understand yourself. So it's very common in our tradition to recommend loving kindness practice to people who have a lot of personal struggle. So, for example, some people have a lot of self-loathing, feel very unworthy or insecure about themselves. And sometimes loving kindness practice is a wonderful medicine for that. Sometimes doing mindfulness practice, and they see what they're doing, they see their self-loathing, then they have more reason to loathe themselves more. This is terrible, I'm doing this. So sometimes mindfulness is actually counterindicated for certain kind of conditions. And with loving kindness, where you learn to cultivate some kindness towards yourself, is a wonderful antidote to hating yourself. And so it takes a while to get the hang of it, but it's a wonderful medicine. Or sometimes it's a medicine for fear, if there's a lot of fear, to cultivate this loving kindness. And it's said in the tradition that cultivating loving kindness this way is a protection for you. It protects you. And I think in the modern spiritual Buddhist circles, people don't think of Buddhist practice for the purposes of protection. Though I think in ancient India, it was a big concern for people to somehow be protected from the difficulties of life, the struggles of life. And it said that loving kindness will protect you. It creates a kind of a field. So how does that work? Is it really a protection? And I think, you know, it's kind of straightforward that if you encounter the world with kindness and warmth, the world will tend to treat you better. There's no guarantee, but it tends to treat you better. And there's been a lot of stories and a lot of situations where I've entered, or people have entered, difficult, tense relationships, maybe it was even antagonistic relationships. And rather than kind of entering that situation guarded and, you know, ready to run or ready to attack or do something, entered with some goodwill for the person, and it disarmed the person. It had come with a gift. And there's a boy in my son's second grade class who's now starting to be some of the other kids are being kind of mean to him, and he's physically a little bit awkward, and some of the girls are kind of rubbing it in him a little bit. And so what the mother has done is she started to invite these kids that were mean to her son over for play dates. And the idea is that they can play together and get to know each other, they'll have a different kind of relationship. So it's actually kind of opening with some goodwill to that situation rather than meeting it with antagonism or defense, or, you know, talking to the principal and the principal has to do something, and, you know. So it changes the whole ecology of the social relationships. It can, if we come with goodwill and generosity. Another reason why loving kindness is said to be a protection is, I don't know if what I'm going to say next day is true, but this is a part of traditional Buddhist psychology. And it says, Buddhist psychology says, that loving kindness, goodwill, is a healthy state of mind to have. And whenever you have a healthy state of mind, the mind will always, as a partner to that healthy state of mind, will always be mindful. There'll always be mindfulness as part of that. In other words, you'll always be paying attention. So, of course, now this means that blind love doesn't work, right? If you fall head over heels in love with someone and you know, you wake up the next morning and say, "Who is that?" That's not clear seeing, right? But loving kindness, this kindness, the goodwill of loving kindness, which is considered quite healthy, comes together with mindfulness, with clear seeing. And when you see clearly, you're protected. You're more likely to know what to do in a situation, how to take care of yourself. So then after I discovered this kind of by accident, you know, this loving kindness thing, then I started getting into doing the practice of it. And then eventually I got to the point where when I didn't feel the goodwill, I thought, you know, this is a great practice. I think I'll try it. And it didn't feel artificial anymore. It didn't feel like I was making something up that shouldn't be there. But it felt like actually it's something that's maybe in a sense always there, available, But sometimes I have to kind of warm the engine, and so to make it part of my life again. So, loving kindness, goodwill. The different ways of translating the word metta, loving kindness, goodwill. Another way of translating is friendliness. So being, it's related to being friendly. So kind of. And then when it's done as a meditation practice, then we're supposed to start with the person for whom it's easiest to do it towards. Now, the Buddha, or these ancient Indian Buddhist teachers, they had never been to America. So it apparently never occurred to them that it can be difficult to do towards oneself. So in the ancient texts, they say, start with yourself. And then from yourself, then go to the next person, next most easiest, because the assumption is yourself is the easiest. And then you go to the next most easiest, or kind of, you know, it doesn't have to be every single person, but you kind of go through categories. And the idea is that you start where it's easiest, and then you're trying to do is to universalize that goodwill, universalize that love. So it's not just limited to you, not just limited to your family, not just limited to the people you know, your friends, but you begin spreading it out into the wider and wider realms of humanity. And being, you know, beings in the world. So, you know, it's one thing to, you know, have goodwill towards a benefactor or to some relative or some friend or someone. But what about having the same level of goodwill to someone who you don't really know? You've seen, you know, sometimes you see it the clerk in the store or a mail carrier or someone who you kind of see occasionally but you have no contact with. What is it to actually have a strong sense of goodwill for that person, like you would have for a good friend? So you're asked in this practice to start doing that. And that arises a lot of questions for people. One of the questions being, why should I? Why should I do it for the mail carrier? And is it safe to do it for the mail carrier? Because, you know, then the mail carrier is going to want to, you know, come in for tea. You know, if I smile or something. Ask how are you or something, you know, it's not safe. Or, you know, why should I do people who I don't care about? You know, what's that about? So those are part, then we grapple with these kinds of issues. And the hope in the traditional instruction for it is we then overcome those obstacles and actually begin to develop a very strong sense of goodwill to people who are called neutral in our lives. And then, if you want to take the practice further, and there are further instructions, and then you go and start doing it with people you have a difficult time with. So first you maybe do somebody you have a teeny bit difficult time with. Just kind of exercise that muscle. Can you have goodwill for someone who irritates you? And then you have to ask yourself, why should I? That person doesn't deserve it. And all kinds of issues come up. And exploring those issues and grappling with them is part of the process. What is it, you know, what is it to see another human being? What is a human being? And how do we look at human beings? And what can we see in human beings? Do we see them through the filter of our preferences, our likes and dislikes? Do we see them through the filter of what they can do for us, both good and bad? Do we see them through the filter of, you know, some particular group that we're a part of and they're not part of or are part of or something? Or can we see some kind of basic humanity in anybody? In a basic humanity, anybody where we would wish to have some goodwill toward them. We want them well. We want them to be happy. Even someone who has made us angry or something. So it becomes a very challenging practice at some point. If you take it that far and begin exploring how can I do this for difficult people. And in fact, the traditional word for this is not difficult people, but is enemies. So the Dalai Lama has this expression, what does he say? I don't remember. But he says, what does he say? Anyway, I forget. So how is it to have love or kindness or goodwill towards people who even maybe even want to harm you? So there's a beautiful story that's told of Buddhist monk, Tibetan Buddhist monk who was put in prison by the Chinese and spent many years there. And then at some point was released or escaped and made his way to Dharamsala, India. And he was asked, about his experience, and he said, you know, it was very difficult. And what was really difficult? Were you ever in real danger? I said, oh yeah. When they were torturing me, I was in danger of losing my compassion for the torturers. Isn't that amazing? Now, why would someone say that? There was a man taken hostage in Lebanon many years ago, 20 years ago, Brian Keenan, I think, who was asked about, you know, aren't you angry at the people who took you? Don't you want vengeance? And he said, no, because if I have resentment and anger and want vengeance against them, I'm harming myself. And I don't want to harm myself. I don't want to add to the harm that's already been there. So when we start talking about, you know, bringing loving kindness to the enemies, it's a pretty tall order. And it can start entering into the realm of, oh, that's for this, you know, the great spiritual geniuses of the ages, not for me. You know. But what is it to begin stretching a little bit into that realm? I said, maybe it's possible for me to stretch myself and expand myself and begin moving a little bit in that direction as a possibility. Without stretching ourselves, while opening to some new possibility, you know, I don't know if there's a spiritual practice, a spiritual life. There needs to be some challenge. And what better place to challenge ourselves than in cultivating love and kindness? So as I think many of you know, the Dalai Lama, who's often a reference for many things in Buddhist, has said publicly many times that his religion is kindness. Rather than saying his religion is Buddhism, he says, my religion is kindness. Or the famous story of Aldous Huxley, who was kind of studied all these different religions and took a lot of hallucinatory drugs and stuff and did all this exploration of spiritual realms and wrote about it. Was asked at the end of his life, you know, what he had learned from all this, what was important after all this study. And he said something like, it's a little bit embarrassing to say that. Say this, he said. But just try to be kinder. Just try to be kinder. Is that good enough? It's recognized in the tradition that teaches loving kindness practice that sometimes doing it, you're not going to feel kind, but instead it's going to evoke anger. And that's considered to be, in a certain kind of funny way, kind of healthy, because as the crusts of the heart fall away, what's buried in there has a chance to show itself. And it needs to show itself. And if anger is buried in there, resentment or grief or something, it needs to have its time to come out and be shown. So rather than being distressed when something like that happens in doing the practice, and the instructions are to be actually in a certain kind of way inviting of it. It's appropriate because there's a cleansing process that's going on. So, this interesting principle that if you want to be happy, don't focus on yourself. But somehow, in particular ways, focus on other people. Not what they can do for you, but rather maybe more what you can do for them, or your love for them, your kindness to them. And the last thing I'll say about the Buddhist notion of loving kindness, this metta, is that it's usually described as a kind of love that doesn't require anything in return. It doesn't require the person to love you in return. And that's actually a very important quality of it. Because the kind of love that needs something in return is not the same thing as loving kindness, it's not the same thing as metta. And so the kind of love that's going to generate happiness and well-being is the kind of love that actually doesn't want anything from the other person. And that itself is a whole challenge then. What's that about then? Why should I want that? And is that fair or that right? Or it's all kind of, it raises all kinds of issues. And it's really well worth working through those issues. So I have no idea what this talk on loving kindness has done for you today. But if you it might actually be really good if some of you didn't like the talk. If you didn't like it for the right reasons, of course. But you were upset by it or disturbed by it or something, kind of, you were kind of like me in my early Zen time, you know, like, oh, what's this? It's artificial, doesn't seem right, or it's, you know, all kinds of issues are, you know, kind of, you have all these protests in your mind about it. Because those very protests might be the place where there's some wisdom can grow and some exploration. So, I'm sorry I talk so much. And it's my intention to give the next three or four or so Monday evenings to talking about these four states of love. So loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Thank you.